Blog Talk Radio.
Blog Talk Radio program. I'm Susan Larison Dance, and today I have to say that every once in a while when I do a write-up of a show that I must submit before it goes on the air, I can hardly begin to incorporate all the deeper aspects of a person's work into the introduction that I write for the show. And today's guest, Parker J. Palmer, is the sort of person who has made such a difference in the world and is continuing to make a difference in the world that any write-up, any introduction I might provide feels lacking in some way, just because his work is an expression so much of his own heart that is pivotal to all of his work. And surrounding this remarkable contribution that he continues to make to our society are all these wonderful accolades and so many books that he's written and such a remarkable life Parker J. Palmer has had. So I will focus here for a moment on these surface-level things that have occurred in his life, which are a reflection of his heart as well. He is the author of Healing the Heart of Democracy, The Courage to Create a Politics Worthy of the Human Spirit. That is his latest book. He is also the author of The Heart of Higher Education, A Call to Renewal, and also A Hidden Wholeness, The Journey Toward an Undivided Life. Another book of his is Let Your Life Speak, Listening for the Voice of Vocation. And then he's quite well known for his book, The Courage to Teach, Exploring the Inner Landscape of a Teacher's Life. Parker is the founder and senior partner for the Center of Courage and Renewal. And today I hope to talk to him about circles of trust, a very interesting concept that he has introduced into many communities, and I find that there is one even in my local area. I live in Portland, Oregon. Parker holds a PhD in sociology from the University of California and 11 honorary doctorates, 2 distinguished achievement awards from the National Educational Press Association, and an award of excellence from the Associated Church Press. In 2010, and this is such an honor, Palmer was given the William Rainey Harper Award, whose previous recipients are just people that we have honored, people of heart in our society. And it is just so wonderful to have someone who has made such a significant contribution, who has so much to share from the heart on the frontier beyond fear. He is also a member of the Religious Society of Friends. He is a Quaker, and this very much has influenced his work as well. His website is up on the show page, CourageRenewal.org, if you're able to see the show page. And I also want to let people know that there is a call-in number to this show, 310-807-5104, as well as an open chat room today. So without further delay, I am just so delighted to welcome Parker J. Palmer on the program. Welcome, Palmer. It's so nice to have you here.
Well, thank you, Susan, and thank you for that lovely introduction. I'm very grateful to be with you.
Well, it is truly a delight to have you here. And I felt that maybe the best way to launch this discussion, because there are just so many ways that we can take this, is one of the things that you define right at the outset in your work is what the heart actually means. And I feel that you really explore that in a way that many of us have not heard. And so I wonder if you could start this with telling us, you know, what is the heart truly? What does it mean to be inspired by the heart?
Well, it's a great question, and it does go right to the heart of the matter, so to speak.
Yeah.
I've been at pains to define the word the way I use it, because I think so often in our culture these days, and for a long time, the heart has simply meant the seat of the emotions in the human self.
Yeah.
It's been a feelingful word, and sometimes a very sentimental word, as in Valentine hearts and so forth. And of course, feelings are important, but the word originally roots in the Latin word cor, C-O-R. So in its ancient and I think truest usage, it points to the core, C-O-R-E, of the human self. And by that I mean, and the word originally meant, that place in us where all of our faculties, all of our ways of knowing and of being in the world converge.
Yes.
So in the heart we find not only feelings, but we also find the intellect, and we find intuition, and we find bodily knowing, and we find relational knowing, and, you know, all of the whole battery of faculties, of modes of knowing, of equipment, you might say, that the human being has with which to integrate our experience and hold what we call our knowledge. And, of course, that knowledge always goes beyond what the mind, what cognitive rationality is able to cope with. I mean, if all we had going for us was our intellects, we'd never be able to say, I love you, to another person, or really appreciate beauty. So, you know, human knowing is a very complex thing, and I think the heart points to the depths of that knowing, and that it's important to use the word in a way that challenges us to try to get access to everything we know and to deploy it in the world in meaningful ways.
Yes, yes. What I so appreciate about how you explore this is the importance of courage. Courage comes up again and again in your work. And, you know, Parker, right now, so many of us, we're feeling somewhat dispirited about the state of things. I mean, I think that's a natural way of feeling sometimes about what seems to be the divisiveness in our society. And something that you've captured in a way I have not seen is that our divisiveness is something to be celebrated in democracy, that it's essential. And I wonder if you could begin to venture into this area, looking into it from the heart space as well, and you know, what is community and what does it mean to be in a democracy and to be people of the heart?
Yeah, again, a great question, and one that is of great interest to me, of course. You know, I think the first thing I would want to say is that people ask me from time to time, especially around the new book on Healing the Heart of Democracy, how can you be so hopeful in a time when so many are in despair about our political life? And the first time I ever answered that question, the answer came right up from my heart, and I still use this answer. I said to the person who was asking me, I said, hope keeps me employed. And I mean by that more than employed as a writer or employed as a speaker. I mean employed as a human being.
Yeah.
Because if I lose hope, what do I do? As far as I can tell, people who lose hope kind of retreat to the corner and face the wall and spend the rest of their lives living there. And that seems to me like a very narrow and cramped way in which to live. I think as long as the human spirit is alive, hope is alive, and we all need to bring that spirit or that heart into our work in the world and into all of our relationships. I think as far as what's going on in our society is concerned, I think the key thing to say is that while divisiveness is a problem and demonization is a problem, and we see a lot of both of those around us these days, diversity is a great richness, a great resource. One of the things I do in the book is to, you know, remind people that scientists, any good scientist will tell you that biodiversity is something absolutely critical to the health of the natural world. I live in Madison, Wisconsin, and I'm a Midwesterner by birth, born in Chicago, and my father's people were from Iowa and so forth. So I'm well acquainted with the agricultural part of our country. And the sadness, of course, is that the diversity of the prairie, as it once was, has so largely been destroyed by what's called monoculture, where just one or two or three varieties of crops are grown, corn, wheat, soybeans, for example. And that has devastated the rich variety of plant life that you can find on a restored prairie, for example. And there are more and more projects going on around the Midwest to restore the prairie, because the cost of monoculture is the depletion of topsoil and the depletion of nutrients and a lack of resilience in the land itself. The prairie, before we started introducing monoculture, would typically have 150, 200 varieties of plant life. And it was that diversity that kept the soil enriched, that allowed for resilience and bounce back, and the development of new species as an older one died out. And I think a strong parallel can be made to our society itself, where our diversity is our richness. Indeed, the founders of the country believed this,
yes.
And they crafted a form of government that, as I like to say, for the first time in human history, it was a form of government that treated diversity and the conflict that comes with diversity not as an enemy, not as the enemy of a good social order, but as the engine of a better social order. They actually designed a government that is meant to hold tension creatively. That's why we have three branches of government at the federal and state level, the executive, the legislative, and the judicial, that hold in tension every issue we consider. They keep tossing it back and forth. They keep stretching it this way and that. And it was really the founders' intention that this creative conflict, as they understood it, go on in perpetuity. That's what they meant when they said, you know, we're working on the formation of a more perfect union. They understood that there would never, we would never reach perfection, but we needed to keep reaching for it by creating a form of government that made good use of the diversity that this land embraces, rather than trying to crush it or quash it, as happens in totalitarian, fascist, autocratic regimes. So just to bring to a close for the moment a topic on which we could talk for a long, long time.
Yes.
It seems to me that we have to understand as Americans that diversity and the conflicts that come with it are actually our greatest asset and not our enemy and not something to be despised.
Yes. And I think that so often many of us don't walk right on the left or the right. I mean, we're somewhere in the middle. And I have to say I've observed with friends on both sides a tendency to want to conform to everything that's being said on a certain side. And I even had a Facebook friend who was deleting people who were disagreeing with things on the left. And yet I see people on the right being that way as well. And I guess something that reading your book really called me to reflect upon is how can we begin to walk this path where it's not this tendency to be authoritarian on either side. I mean, I think it's a concern. It's a concern. When the president is a Republican, the Democrats are concerned that president's being authoritarian in some way with executive orders and such. And then I'm hearing it now from the right. You know, they're concerned that the separation of powers that you talk about is breaking down. And that, you know, via executive order, via, you know, the response we had to 9/11 and all the different things that went into effect, that we are destroying the fabric of our society. And I'm seeing this from both sides. And I wonder, since this is so very important right now, how do you respond to that, Parker? What do you see and where is the hope?
Mm-hmm. Well, what I say when I talk to audiences about this is, first of all, have you ever noticed how almost all of our talk about politics in this country, and put that phrase in quotes, our talk about politics, is about them and not about us? It's always about people who are in Washington, D.C., or who are in the state capitol. It's about those folks who are messing us up in our common life and in our individual lives. And I ask people a very simple question. When was the last time in your everyday life, in your family, in your neighborhood, among your friends, at work, when talking about people who aren't in the room solved any problem? And I think the answer to that question is never, because that's not a mode of problem solving. So my first response to this is this country was founded on the words "we the people," and we have to refocus our political conversations on us, not them, because what's going on in Washington, and there are all kinds of ways of proving this, what's going on in Washington, D.C., and in some of our state capitals, is divorced from reasonable readings of the will of the people. And that's partly because we the people are at each other's throats in exactly the way you've described, with friends unfriending each other on Facebook because they can't even tolerate looking at a particular expression of political opinion that one of their friends has. And so rather than engaging that creatively, they simply, with a click of the mouse, get rid of you.
Yeah.
There's, you know, ultimately, there's something very, very worrisome about that habit, and I'm going to name it, but then move back to hopeful possibilities.
Yeah.
If we look historically at societies where the majority has literally gotten rid of the minority, or where people have gotten rid of each other because they disagree with each other, we're really looking at evil in history. We're really looking at fascism at work. And anything that even points in the direction of getting rid of those who disagree with us or who are different from us, I think is something that we need to blow the whistle on just as quickly as possible. There are many historical examples, and I'm sure they're coming to mind right now to you and to your thoughtful listeners. But the point I want to make is that there is a way, there are proven ways to hold conversations across lines of difference that allow us to hang in with each other. And I'd be glad to talk about one of those right now if you'd like me to, Susan.
Yes, please do. Please do.
Well, one of my favorite examples is a series of workshops that I know about and that I have some experience with, where people are brought together who hold different opinions on a very contentious issue. Let's take an issue like abortion, which we all know is a meaningful issue, a significant issue, and people on all sides of the abortion debate hold very strong feelings about it. Well, in a day-long workshop of the sort that I've experienced and am thinking about right now, people are brought together, maybe 25 or 30 of them, for an entire day during which they are prohibited from announcing their position on the issue until the very last hour of the day.
Yeah.
Before that last hour, trained facilitators are helping them learn how to craft and tell their life story to each other, especially that part of the life story that led them to whatever position they hold on this difficult issue of abortion or gun control or whatever else it may be. They spend most of the day telling their stories to each other in small group and large group settings. And then at the end of the day, during that last hour when they can announce their position to each other on the issue, something new happens. And that is that people are hearing those positions in the context of a life story which has made this person a real human being for them.
Yeah.
As I like to say, the more you know about another person's story, the less possible it is to dismiss, distrust, or dislike that person. There's simply something so humanizing about hearing the story that took me to position X rather than simply hearing me announce position X and make my argument for it. Now, are people's minds changed at the end of that workshop? Usually not, but that's not the point. The point is that they've learned to hold differences in a much more creative way, to be open to the possibility that somebody else has a legitimate way of looking at an issue, even though it's different from theirs. The humanizing thing has set in, and we've cranked this down from the level of abstract ideology down to the place where we all live, which, again, is that heart place, because these are all stories that come from the heart, and they're often about brokenheartedness and what that brokenheartedness leads to. And people are often stunned, amazed to find out that essentially the same life story can lead two people to two different positions. But that's a humanizing piece of knowledge. So bottom line for me is this, that we need to understand that in conversations of the sort you and I are talking about, it's more important to be in right relationship than it is to be right.
Yes.
That's a little formula that I've been trying to live by, and I find that it works. And that doesn't mean that I don't think there are issues of right and wrong or true and false, but if we don't create containers that are strong relational containers that can hold this an ongoing conversation about right and wrong, true and false, then we're never going to have an opportunity to work together on those issues and to educate each other, to inform each other, and to create the kind of civic or civil community that the founders of this country intended when they used the words, we the people. So just to take us back to national and state politics for a moment, one of the reasons for this gap between the decision-making that goes on in distant centers of that sort and the will of the people as measured by such things as reputable public opinion polls, one of the reasons for that, these gaps, is that we don't have our act together as we the people.
Yes.
To a sufficient extent to voice our common concerns to those who are in power. And you know, part of the sadness here for me, Susan, is that the simple fact is that billions of dollars are spent every year to divide us, to set us against one another.
Yeah.
That's done by media, both on the air and online, that speak exclusively for the left or exclusively for the right. Not really news media, but infotainment media,
yeah,
who know that there are big bucks to be made in demonizing the other side. The billions are also spent on political action committees that produce political ads that are attack ads rather than solution ads. We all know these things, and what we ought to be doing, rather than watching it and buying into it, is getting angry at the fact that billions of dollars are being spent to divide and conquer, which is one of the oldest of all tactics in politics or warfare. We ought not to let anyone set us against each other, but we ought to be doing the kind of thing that I was just talking about in these workshops, where people actually get to know each other on a human level and connect heart to heart so that they can create those trustworthy containers for conversation.
Yes. You know, there's something that came to mind as you were talking about the media. I heard it was on a comedy, political comedy show. I heard this really poignant comment about what's going on online, and I wanted to get your comment on this. Basically, online, if you go to a news site nowadays, it reads the kind of stories that you like to look at. And so then you're presented with more of those types of stories. And what was presented on this program, which really gave me pause for thought, is that what this means is that we are not being exposed to the diversity of even just basic information about our world. And the death of the paper newspaper, which, by the way, I still get because I find all kinds of things, even though they're getting smaller and smaller on the pages of my paper newspaper, it's not being customized to, oh, you know, Susan likes to read. You know, I was looking at a lot of healthcare articles for a while. Now all I see are healthcare articles that come up, you know, just tons of them. And that's an example of what goes on. So if you were, say, a far-right conspiracy person, and I'm not being judgmental. I actually know people like that and are my friends. I managed to be friends with a diversity of people without having to agree with everything that they say. But say you had a certain viewpoint, then all these stories are going to come to you online that then verify that viewpoint and continue to explore that viewpoint, and you're not exposed to other sorts of stories. How would you comment on that, Parker? Because that seems to be a rather harmful thing that's happening to us online.
Absolutely, and you're absolutely right. I've seen that research myself, and that's a fact of electronic life because it's all about selling us what they think we want to buy, And so they keep sort of like, you know, driving the herd in that direction, or separating out parts of the herd and driving them in different directions. So I think the answer is, or one answer is, that in the institutions that in which people grow up, and I'm talking now especially about schools, but also about families, about religious communities, about voluntary associations of various sorts, we need to educate people to be good consumers of the online media. And I don't mean consumers in the limited sense of what it is we directly purchase when we go to Amazon or some other vendor, for example, but consumers in terms of what it is we read and think about and expose ourselves to and end up ingesting. I think historically that's been one of the, I remember when I was a kid. I'm 75 now, so I'm not exactly close to my childhood. But when I was a kid, my dad, especially, who was a businessman in Chicago, talked a fair amount with me about being a smart consumer. You know, about bait and switch, about advertising and how falsifying and exaggerating it can be, about making my own judgments and decisions about the quality of a product, about getting a second opinion, comparing
yes.
products, so forth and so on. Well, we need to be doing the same with kids when it comes to their consumption of the media. Online and in print media, because it is possible to, I sit at a computer every day, as many of us do. I'm a writer. It's the way I make my living. But it is possible to dominate the computer rather than have it dominate me. It's possible to tab and bookmark, as I have done, a variety of news sources that are left, right, and center. So that every day I'm looking at the Drudge Report as well as Huffington Post, you know.
And trying
to see what a diversity of people have to say. I'll even check in on some of the conspiracy theory sites. And you know, to go lower on the food chain, check out what people on the hate sites are saying, because it will energize you to love and to understand how much love is needed in our world these days. So, you know, I think in a way it's a new issue in a way, but it's in another way it's a very old issue. And the old issue is, who's in charge of my life? That's one that people have been asking for generations and for millennia, for centuries anyway, and have been trying to come up with answers to, that preserve our own identity and integrity and preserve our own freedom.
Yes. You know, something, Parker, when you talk about how listening to these diversity of sources, it teaches us to love. There's something that I have been pondering, and I have tried to explain it to people who are more on the left. And I lean somewhat left of center, just so you know. Now, I haven't always. I told you before you got on the show, I'm the granddaughter of an evangelical minister, and there were very strong conservative influences in my life. But something that I have reflected on many times is that, how can we learn to love the people, many people I personally know in my family, many people I personally love, who have been taught that even politics, in fact, especially politics, basically everything, it's not just demonization with quotes around it. They are truly taught that they are engaging in spiritual warfare in this world, and that there really are, from when I was 4 years old, probably the soonest I could know, I was taught there were demons all around, true demons. And I know this is an uncomfortable topic, It's as if people don't want to hear it. It's like they want to either say it's a joke or, I don't want to hear that. But to really get inside the psyches, and I know you have, of what it means to be on the right, you have to understand this mindset of believing that they are in a spiritual war, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
and that causes the fear. And how can we reach out in love?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, I think. And I certainly know people on the right who operate from that kind of premise. But
yes.
I think it's I always like to reach as much as I can for a level playing field when we explore topics like this. So
yes.
I need to say that as a left-leaning person myself, I've plenty of friends on the left who have their own version of demon possession that they project on folks on the right. They don't express it theologically. They don't think of it in terms of, of actual demonic figures lurking in the physical or metaphysical world. But they might as well, because they believe in a kind of possession of mind and heart and spirit and so forth that leads people to, act against their own best interests, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it generates in them fear of the other, fear of the political stranger, as it were. There may be a fair number of people on the left who will claim that, that they have no problem walking across lines of race or ethnicity, or social class, but they certainly have problems walking across lines of religious belief and political ideology. And I think, fear has a lot to do with it on the left and on the right and in the middle. Fear, it seems to me, is one of the most fundamental, most endemic of human dilemmas. And it's something, again, that we ought to be addressing in our educational system and in our religious communities and in the family and all of those local venues of life where people either get formed or deformed. I'm a Christian. I'm a Quaker Christian. I've thought a lot about a passage in the scriptures that says, "Be not afraid." And for a long time, I have found an equivalence to that passage in the spiritual texts of all the world religions that I know anything about. Be not afraid seems to be, a sort of very basic counsel coming from all of the wisdom traditions, because in a way, every wisdom tradition, every spiritual or religious tradition is fundamentally addressed to the fear that comes with being human, which is ultimately about the fear of dying, or the fear of failing, or the fear of losing, the fear of getting hurt, so forth and so on. The fears that come with being an embodied creature in a very challenging world. Well, I'm a person who has known a lot of fear in my life. And when I first ran across that passage as a young person, I felt very indicted by it. I felt like, I must be falling short because I have fears. But as I grew older, I became more discerning about what that passage does and doesn't say. And what it says is not that you can't have fear. It says that you don't need to be your fear. And this is why, among other things, I wrote a book called The Courage to Teach with a subtitle, exploring the inner landscape of a teacher's life. Well, we can all explore the inner landscapes of our lives. And when we do so, when we take that inner journey and become discerning about what's going on inside of us, we will indeed find that there are places in that landscape that if you were to draw a map of it, you would name those places fear. But yeah. There are other places in our inner landscapes as well. There are places of faith, there are places of hope, there are places of trust, there are places of fellow feeling, you know, all these locations on our inner landscape that have names that we can attach to them. And it's possible to make a conscious choice about where do I want to stand within my inner landscape as I approach the next person or take on the next task or engage in the next conversation. Do I choose to stand in a place of fear? If I do, then I'm going to be creating more fear around me because my fearful response to the other person is going to be responded to in kind. And pretty soon we've created a fearful mess by operating from and evoking from each other all that fear that is in the human self. But I have also found that if I approach another person from a place of trust, from a place of faith, I may get nicked or stub my toe or even hurt a little along the way, but eventually, in most cases, I start evoking that same quality in that other person. You know, there's something in all of us. There's something in this rich mix, this rich complex place called the human heart that wants something better.
Yes.
And if we kind of call out to that place in each other, we kind of invite forth that place in each other, appeal to that place in each other, then that something better can often start happening. But it does take the living of a conscious life and the making of conscious decisions about where do I want to stand as I approach the world, my work in the world, and my relationships in the world.
Yes. You know, lately, Parker, I've been reflecting on this concept of heaven on earth, and that when you speak that, you know, we have a feeling in our heart that there's something better. Now heaven on earth is a very dramatic something better. But I wonder if we don't all just feel, and it's certainly a part of the Christian path on from the left to the right of Christianity, and let's not forget, this is a time of hope. We're right upon Easter weekend, and this Thursday today is a time of broken openness, really.
Mm-hmm.
But again, what about this feeling that, you know, not just incremental hope, but just that we are capable of tremendous transformation. And it
mm-hmm.
seems that this is shared. It's not just in one religious group. I mean, it's said in different ways. And what
mm-hmm.
do you feel about this concept of tremendous transformation, you know, miraculous transformation?
Mm-hmm.
How? What are your thoughts on that, Parker?
Well, people ask me if I believe in miracles, and I'll say sure because I've lived them.
Yeah,
and I think you know most people have, one way or another. I suppose one of the most meaningful examples I can offer, Susan, is the fact which I've written about and I speak about that three times in my adult life. I have suffered from very profound clinical depression.
Yeah.
And whenever I talk about this, I'm always eager to say that there's a lot of mystery about depression. You know, any good medical person will say there's much they don't understand about depression. But we do know that they come in very different types. Some are almost strictly biochemical. Some are almost strictly situational. But then the two get confused or tangled up with each other, And so it's a very hard thing to sort out. I think my depressions were situational, maybe influenced a bit by some DNA that has been in my family over several generations, so partly biochemical. But the point here is, while wanting to not make gross generalizations about a very complicated subject, I've experienced resurrection three times after months of wondering if today is the day that I kill myself because life is so utterly bereft and devoid of meaning. I've, you know, somehow been given the grace and the help to hang on long enough to find the light beginning to return and to find the miracle of new life on the other side of what I would have to call a living death, because that's what depression has been for me, a living death, as close as I will ever come in life to actually dying. I wrote about this in a book, little book called Let Your Life Speak. There's a chapter on depression called All the Way Down. And one of the things I say there is sort of shocking to some people, but I'll say it again here because it's my truth. I say, you know, I hear a lot of talk about folks who get depressed and take their lives. And, of course, there's an enormous amount of depression and way too much suicide in our society. And people will say, I don't understand why so-and-so took his or her life. Well, I understand it. And the answer is because depression is absolutely the most exhausting experience I have ever had in my life. And the person who commits suicide needs the rest. That's just the way it is when you're in that place of utter exhaustion and feeling that you do not have one more atom of energy in you to keep on living. You need the rest. What I don't understand, the mystery for me, is why it is and how it is that some people come through that darkness, come out the other side, not finding themselves not only alive but thriving, which is how it's been for me on three different occasions. And so, do I believe in miracles? Do I believe in major transformations? Absolutely. I believe in major transformations as big as life emerging out of death, because I've been there and I've done that. And, you know, once you get that message, you look around you and you see a lot of miracles happening that you might not have seen before. So, you raised the question of heaven. There's also this phrase in Christian tradition, it used to be the kingdom of God, but people these days are more likely to talk about the kingdom of God or the beloved community. And there are wonderful passages in Scripture where Jesus, I think is, you know, so often put in a glass case, his teaching is not understood at the sort of simple ground level of being human, where I hear him always standing. When Jesus in the Scriptures is asked, well, where is this magical place called the kingdom of God or the beloved community that you keep talking about? You know, where will we find it? And Jesus' answer is very simple. He says, it's right here, right now. It's within us and it's between us. And that's what I believe, because I have experienced groups of people, I've experienced individuals reaching within them to find that that beloved community or the stuff of which beloved community is made. And I have experienced individuals discovering between themselves in community the same thing. So absolutely, I not only believe it to be true, I know it to be true.
Yes. Well, I'm really happy that you did explore that to some degree, because, you know, depression has become rampant in our world. And I know you speak in your book about the inner emptiness that many feel. And I will tell you personally, I have experienced it myself, postpartum, that lingered. I mean, I know what it feels like too. And many of us have had it come to us in different ways. And, you know, it seems, Parker, that when we come out of this, and I had a miraculous transformation, I feel, and many of us have stories of this, you know, when we talk about the stories of our lives, I mean, nothing brings us more hope. I wouldn't have a radio show about fear. I mean, I don't have a radio show about fear because I'm totally fearless. It's because
right.
I've had to explore my relationship with fear. And you made a quote, there's a quote in one of your books, quote, "I am both my shadow and my light, and the two cannot be separated." And I wrote down so many quotes. I took a number of notes from your books, and we can never capture the essence of everything that you are and have expressed in an hour, but that really caught me, and that there is hope, too. There is hope beyond the shadow and the light.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the things that I like to say, because it's been powerfully true for me, is that we do a lot of talking about wholeness in our circles, and I think that sometimes people hear that word as a kind of counsel of perfection, you know, oh yeah, I'm supposed to become whole. How in heaven's name is that going to happen? And what's the truth, I believe, is pretty simple. Wholeness does not mean perfection, because that ain't in the cards for any of us. We are imperfect beings in an imperfect world, and we might as well settle for it because it's just the way it is. But there is something called wholeness, which has to do with embracing everything you are, your shadow as well as your light, your weakness as well as your strength. And transformation happens when people are able to do that. That includes the transformation of relationships. I mean, the person who is standing only in his or her strength, you know, the stuff I do well, the stuff where I succeed, the stuff where I'm victorious, there's no way to connect with other people from that side of life. That sets you apart from other people who so many of whom are feeling like schlumps and failures and, you know, riddled with darkness. I mean, aren't we all at some level when we get honest, fraudulent, whatever? But if you embrace everything you've got, including your weakness and your failures and your shadow, that's how you start connecting with others. I'm a great fan of this singer-songwriter, poet Leonard Cohen, and he has this wonderful song in which these lines appear. He says, "Forget your perfect offering. Ring the bells that still can ring. There's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in." And it's, you know, it's not only how the light gets into us, it's how other people can connect with us through those cracks in what otherwise would be armor that we go around wearing. So I love the fact that you have a show that's about fear, because it's so fundamental in human life, and there are ways to hold it that are life-giving rather than death-dealing. There are ways to understand it.
Yes. You know, when I first started this show, Parker, we're running out of time, but I'll tell you, at first I wanted to say, no, you know, the frontier beyond fear is beyond all fear. And then I started having guests come on who would tell me about their positive relationship with fear, and they really helped me. I learned so much from my guests. I feel like this show is my own It's a personal exploration that just we then share with whoever is listening. And I am just so appreciative of how people come to this show so open. And, you know, we are rapidly running out of time. We're in the last 5 minutes. And I just wanted to say I am just so thankful that you allowed your openness coming through the cracks of your heart to connect with mine and to connect with the audience today. And I also want to give you at least a brief opportunity to speak a little bit about the Center for Courage and Renewal, because I know that's something that's very near and dear to your heart. And so I'll give you the opportunity to wrap up in whatever way you feel led, Parker. But just,
well,
I just want
well,
to say thank you,
Susan. And no, let me, before our time runs out, thank you again for having me on the show. I really enjoyed the conversation. And I wish you all the best with this important work. So I'm just simply going to invite, in I guess we have 3 or 4 minutes left, invite people to check out the Center for Courage and Renewal, which is at www.couragerenewal.org. So it's just couragerenewal.org. And it's a website that's soon to see big changes by the end of the month. But there's a lot of information on there, and there will be more information soon. I think the best way to put it is this. I've written 9 books, and over the last 40 years, you named a number of them up front. And the Center for Courage and Renewal is a place that I helped found. I founded 20 years ago that puts wheels on my ideas. And by that I mean that they create vehicles that, in the form of retreats and other programs, in which people can actually ride towards destinations of their own choosing around some of the ideas that we've talked about today. So there's nothing we've talked about today that isn't worked with in what we call Circle of Trust retreats, which we offer in part for teachers and physicians and clergy and nonprofit leaders and other professionals who are doing important work in the world, people in healthcare also. But we also offer them for anyone who's interested. And you can go to the Courage and Renewal website and find a calendar listing events. As you said, some are in your area there in Portland.
Yes, they are.
We now have 210 facilitators.
Oh, dear. Seems like, Parker, I don't know if you can hear me, but you got disconnected right at the last minute. I'm not hearing Parker, although it may be coming through to the audience. I'm not sure. Sounds like something on the line. So I'm going to switch to a different phone just to see if that's helpful.
Parker, can you hear me? Okay, it seems like Parker got disconnected right at the last minute here. Now I have an echo. There we go. So since we're in the last minute of the show, I'm just going to have to offer a silent thank you, because I don't know if he can hear or not, to Parker Palmer. Occasionally we have phone issues. It seems like he just cut out right at the end. But I do invite you to go to his website, couragerenewal.org, and learn all about the work that he's involved in. And the many books that he has written are all listed there, and I encourage you to explore his work more deeply. And hopefully he'll listen to this or maybe can hear. But I am just in such a space of gratitude for him coming on the show today, because it really is all about understanding our relationship with community has a lot to do with our relationship with fear. So thank you, everyone, for being here. The next show is tomorrow, 9 a.m. Pacific, 12 p.m. Eastern. Dr. Robert Foreman, author of Enlightenment 8, What It's Cracked Up to Be, is going to be on the show tomorrow. at 9 a.m. Pacific, and he's a returning guest. And that will be, we'll be talking about his book tomorrow and what enlightenment means to him. So thank you, everyone, for being here, and I will see you again soon. And I hope that you take to heart the wonderful concepts that we all shared in today. Thank you.